Welcome to part two of America Strikes Back, the story of the Doolittle Raid. This program is produced by the American Veterans Center and World War II Veterans Committee in association with Radio America. To hear this and other documentaries, visit www.americanveteranscenter.org. After Lieutenant Colonel Doolittle and the 16 planes under his command unloaded their bombs on targets in Japan, all but one of the aircraft then proceeded southwest along the southern coast of Japan towards eastern China, where several fields in the Zhejiang province were to be ready to guide in the raiders, then recover and refuel them. The crews would then fly to Chongqing, but the raiders faced many challenges as they continued their flights to China. Not only were all of the aircraft severely low on fuel, the weather was rapidly deteriorating and nightfall had made navigation difficult. None of the planes would have reached China were it not for a fortuitous tailwind that increased the speed of each plane by at least 25 knots. As Major Tom Griffin recalls, realizing they would not be able to make their intended destination, each crew had the choice of either bailing out over China or crash landing along the Chinese coast.
We all... went 50 miles out to sea as though we were returning to carriers out there to confuse the Japanese. Of course, we couldn't land on a carrier. From the beginning, we had a plan to continue on to China and land in this field. And the weather was entirely against us until late afternoon when we got down to the southern part of the Japanese islands and headed across the China Sea. We'd had no change in the weather that had been predicted. But going across the China Sea, we got a beautiful strong tailwind. And instead of coming up short, about 100 or 150 miles short, with this strong tailwind, all of us, at least reached the China coast. And our computations during those hours was that we were going to come up short and have to ditch. But the strong tailwind got us to China. Four of our crews ditched in the water right along the coast, and 11 of us pulled up into the storm. It was nighttime now, and we're in a big... See, plane number 9 that I was in the air for 15 and a half hours. That was the length of our flight before we ran out of gas over China. And so we'd been up in the air a long time. It was nighttime, and we pulled up into this storm, 11 of the planes, four ditched along the water. 11 of us pulled up into the storm. One went to Vladivostok, Russia, incidentally. And we pulled up into the storm with 10 other planes and flew into the storm until we ran out of gas and we all bailed out. 55 men bailed out of 11 planes.
Major General David Jones remembers the bailout of Plane 5.
About an hour and a half off of takeoff, as a matter of fact. We were cruising and... The way the airplane is set up, you have people in the front, and then the bomb bay is just a little space about this big between the front and the back. And we had engineer gunner in the back end. And old Sergeant Maskey, well, he's, 18 years old, 19, I guess, he's an old guy. He called up, he said, "Sir, we don't have enough gas." I said, "That's right." I think that was the end of the story. after the target and we're withdrawing, we got on the southwest course, and the navigator's taking sun lines almost continuously. And he called up, X hours away. He said, "Hell, I don't think we got but 100 miles to swim, and we're in good shape." And by the time we got to the southern tip of Kyushu, we had picked up this tailwind of at least 40 knots for a good several hours, literally. And by the time we got to the southern tip of Kyushu, turning west, we got enough juice to give it. We knew that. We knew we had enough to get to land. He flew and ran out of gas and jumped out.
General Jimmy Doolittle and co-pilot Lieutenant Colonel Richard Cole described the bailout of Plane 1.
It was dark by the time we got to the coast of China. So it was night. I was up about 9,000 feet and finally flew till I got as close as I could to where I thought the field was. And at that point, there was no use going further. So I told everybody to bail out, And then when they were all out but me, they had a little hiatus there. The co-pilot, as he started to jump, had his parachute catch on the back of his seat. And so he was dangling. He couldn't get his feet on the ground. He couldn't get his hand. And so I put the plane on gyropilot, shut off the gasoline so the engines would stop and it would come on down, and then lifted him off and dropped him and then followed him out.
We had flown below all the way, and the drift meter was covered up with salt spray, so he couldn't take any kind of drift deal. And there was a high overcast, and he couldn't take a sun shot, so it was strictly a dead reckoning. As we flew along, we began to notice that the water was beginning to change color.
Yeah.
We're changing from the green, blue-green, to getting a little tanner. So we knew that that was coming off of the land somewhere. We just kept flying, and like Bill said, that the props were going around so slow that you could almost read that Hartzell propeller sticker. And we hit the coast. There was a big storm over China at that time, so we had to go. We went on instrument almost right away when we hit the coast. And we climbed up to 9,000 feet. We tried to the radio to pick up the homing station that was supposed to be there on 4495 kilocycle, and had no luck because something had happened to it on the way to the place we were supposed to be. So. We climbed up to 9,000 feet, and Colonel Doolittle said that we had no alternative but to keep flying to run out of fuel. And when that happened, why, we all jumped. I ended up in a pine tree. I was probably the luckiest one of the bunch, but she drifted over this pine tree, and I couldn't see the ground, so I pulled a part of the canopy in and made kind of a hammock affair and spent the night, a scared night, in the tree.
Several planes, including Staff Sergeant David Thatcher's Plane 7 and Major Ed Saylor's Plane 15, attempted to make water landings along the Chinese coast.
Pilot spotted a strip of beach there and thought he could land on it. He had the wheel down, but almost dark and raining and misjudged the distance. And we hit the water with a wheel down, and that stopped us immediately and tore both engines out. All the other four members of the crew were all thrown out through the nose. I was in the back, knocked unconscious for a short while, and then I came to, and the water coming in what I thought was the bottom of the airplane. I tried to get out there, finally realized that the airplane was upside down, and the plexiglass on the turret had shattered, and that's where the water was coming in. So I was able to work my way back to the escape hatch on the bottom of the plane, open that, and crawl out on the airplane. And when I got out, then I walked to the tail of the airplane on the bottom of it and stepped off in the water, and it was just waist deep, so we were pretty close to shore. All the other four crew were pretty badly injured. And we went down in occupied territory on another island. And that next morning, then, they were so seriously injured, they all had to be carried, all four of them.
Our ship made a water landing by an island. Cause it was getting dark, it was raining, stormy, and see that silhouette of an island. We were afraid to pull up through the soup and try to get over land to bail out, which most of them did. But our gas gauges were banging on empty, and we didn't know if we tried to go up through that soup and bail out up there somewhere, whether we would land in friendly hands or not. Japan had all of that area they wanted. They come and gone around there. Anything they wanted, they had. So we decided to land in the water. Worked out okay.
Plane 8, severely low on fuel and piloted by Captain Edward York, made the decision to land in Vladivostok, Russia, thinking he could convince the Russians to let them refuel their plane. Plane 16, piloted by Lieutenant William Farrow and the survivors of Plane 6, landed in Japanese-occupied territory. Colonel Glines explains the fate of those crews.
One aircraft, the carburetors had been finely tuned at Eglin Field before they all left for the West Coast, be loaded on the carrier. But through a misinformation, some mechanics had taken the carburetors off the one airplane and found out that they were so mistuned according to the regulations that they put them back into what they're supposed to have been. But they had been so finely tuned that they, for better cruise control and more distance on the aircraft. But that airplane, they didn't catch it in time. So when that crew, they bombed their target. But the pilot made the command decision, we're never going to make it. We'll be out in the middle of the China Sea with the fuel consumption that we've got now. So he elected to land near Vladivostok in Russia, thinking that he could talk the Russians into gassing his airplane up and then go to China and join everybody else. So he was the only airplane that landed safely without any damage in Russian territory. The Russians did not want a war with Japan at their back door when they're having to fight so viciously on the front door against the Germans. So it was they were remaining neutral, and this was proof that they were neutral, if the Japanese doubted it or anybody doubted it. Here's one crew they can prove. We'll turn the airplane and we'll turn the crew. Eight of them were captured by the Japanese and put in solitary confinement and tortured and starved. And the Japanese were so humiliated by that surprise attack, which had been precisely as they had done at Pearl Harbor from a carrier. They never got over that. And they had a mock court-martial of the eight men, and they condemned three of them to death by firing squad. And they were put to death by firing squad. A fourth man died a year later from malnutrition.
After the bailouts and crash landings, the Doolittle Raiders were spread all over parts of eastern China. Major Ed Saylor and Staff Sergeant David Thatcher recall their encounters with the Chinese.
Well, we swam to the shore about a half mile from where we landed, and there was an island, and it was all Chinese fishermen, and of course there was no communication at all. They didn't know anything that we hoped they would. So one of the fishermen took us over to the next island, and from that island another guy rowed us over to the mainland. The Japanese gunboats were going around and around the island at night. In the daytime, they would go ashore and steal all the chickens and food and anything that the natives had. And then at night, they would patrol around the island. So we had this guy had to row pretty fast to get out of their sight before they came back around. And then on the second island, we wound up on top of a little mountain where there was a Buddhist priest and a little temple there. And we went in there, and he determined that we should stay overnight. We shouldn't go on. He had a tin can about the size of that little canister with sticks in it, with writing on the sticks. And he would shake that can until some sticks fell out, and then he'd read what it said on the stick. And he said, shook his head and went like the sun going down, and we had to stay there. And then the next morning, he got us, we slept on the floor in that temple. The next morning, he took us in another room under a bed and slid the wall back And we all crawled into a cave, along with a Chinese, some kind of a soldier, I don't know. I just call him a guerrilla. But he was in there with us. And we spent most of the day in there. And the Japanese tracked us up to that little temple by our footprints. Our shoes had heels on them. And there was the only shoes on that island with heels. So they, and there was a little mud around, so they tracked us up there. And we could see up to the roof of the cave. There was a tree up there and a big old crack in the ceiling of the cave. And we sat there and watched some Japanese feet go back, back and forth up there and listened to them yelling around. And after a few hours, they left. And the old guy come and got us, and then the next day we left.
It took us 3 days to get to hospital after the crash, and the fellow didn't have any medical attention, whatever. There's nothing over there, no sanitation. We got the hospital, and there was a Chinese doctor and his son had the hospital at Lin Hai, and my crew stayed there then. And then that's the first place we had an interpreter, too. There was a missionary from England was there so they could translate for us. And that is where my pilot had to have his leg amputated, that hospital. And then I went on with Ed's crew and went on inland, and the doctor that was on his crew stayed there with my crew to help them. Gradually moved inland by walking or riding in sedan chairs, rode in a rickshaw all one morning, and finally got to where the trail was wide enough for an automobile to pick us up.
General Jimmy Doolittle and Major Tom Griffin described their confrontations with the Chinese.
Started out in the morning and walked down a road and came to a Chinese. He couldn't have been more Chinese if he'd been a picture. An old Chinaman with one of these yokes on and with the two honey buckets hanging on the yoke. So I stopped him, and he spoke no English. So I had a pencil and paper. I got out the pencil and paper and drew a picture of a locomotive on a railroad track, and then drew a picture of a little house, station. And he understood fine. He said, right, whatever, right in Chinese. Took me right down to the nearest military barracks and turned me in. There was a major there who fortunately spoke a little English. He said, the first thing is, I'll take your 45. And I said, no, we're allies. And allies don't take each other's sidearms. And I finally retained my 45 by telling him that all he had to do was come with me, and I would show him the place just a few blocks from there where I had landed in the rice paddy. I would take him to the house where the people would verify the fact that I had landed and knocked on their door, and there he would find my parachute, which I had taken off and left there in the mud. And so we went back, and the house was there, but no parachute. So we went to the house, and the Chinese assured him that neither was there any parachute, but neither had there been any aviator, and there was something very fishy about this. Well, the situation became very hairy there for a moment. But one of the Chinese soldiers had a little more sense than the rest of us, and so he went in the house, and back in the corner was a little shelf about head high. And he went up back on that shelf, and there was a parachute. So from then my story stood up, and we went from frowns to smiles. Started, walked to the governor's house. That was an all-day walk. The rest of the crew came in the following day. Each one of them had their interesting stories. Perhaps the most, that's the rest of my crew. There were five of us in the airplane. I didn't know where the other 16 airplanes were. It was a real worrisome period. Paul Leonard, this little mechanic and gunner, was a real tough little cookie. He didn't know whether he landed in Japanese occupied territory or Chinese occupied territory. And a bunch of Chinese tried to save him. And he went up a hill and got behind a rock, and every time they'd come up to save him, he'd break out his 45 and cut down on them and chase them down the hill. And it wasn't until they got one of the other boys to identify them that he would permit himself to be saved.
We got farther inland to China than any of the other crews. We were 300 miles into China before we ran out of gas in Vietnam. We're still in the storm at night, at 1 o'clock in the morning there. And the next day, three of us got together from our crew, from our five-man crew. We couldn't find the other two for some days. But three of us wandered down through the Chinese farmlands there. It was raining all day. And late in the afternoon, we got a Chinese farmer to allow us to go into his house and dry our clothes off around his stove. And while we were doing that, his farmhouse was surrounded by Chinese soldiers because the people in that area had told them that these odd-looking characters with pistols and all were wandering through the countryside. And they surrounded this farmhouse. Fortunately, nobody was shot, but when we looked up from our wringing our clothes out around this stove, rifles were pointing at us from all the doors and windows. And there was a Chinese officer in the door with a big scroll in Chinese. I don't know what that ever said. I went up to him and I said what I'd been trained to say, Lushu Megwa Fuji, which is supposed to mean I'm an American. And it didn't mean anything to him. He just pushed the pistol closer to my nose. So they held us prisoner overnight. They didn't know who we were. And the next day, we went down to a town up in the mountains there where they were. And as the people came to the gate of this town, there were three Caucasian men in black robes, and there were missionaries from a St. Louis religious group. And, of course, they spoke English, and we told them who we were and what we'd done. And then everything was okay. And that's how we went. Then the ensuing weeks, days and weeks, the Chinese got most of our people out of Japanese-held territory. See, we went into Japanese-held territory, and they got most of our people out of there.
Many of the raiders were left to navigate the land to Chungking alone. Lieutenant Colonel Richard Cole recalls his first morning.
Well, the next morning, I climbed down. I was about 12 feet off the ground. And the next morning, I had a compass and packed the chute up into a backpack affair, and I decided I was going to stay in the high ground because I was in an area that was quite hilly. But I figured my chances of not getting captured would be better than looking for some line of communication. So I walked all day, and I saw two or three woodcutters. And they didn't pay any attention to me. About dusk, I came out on a cliff, and down below was a couple of buildings, and one of them had some kind of a flag hanging above it. And so I walked down there, and I was accosted by a kid. And he took me into a building that was empty except for a table. And on the table was a piece of paper with a sketch of a two-tailed airplane with five parachutes coming out of it. And I finally got him to take me where they took the individual that made the sketch. And so we went to another building, and I walked in, and there was Jimmy Doolin. And I said, boy, am I glad to see you. And we greeted each other, and he said, I'm happy you didn't get hurt or anything. And maybe a couple hours later, why, the guerrillas brought in the rest of the crew.
As Major General David Jones, Major Ed Saylor, and Staff Sergeant David Thatcher soon realized, the Chinese were very grateful to the Americans.
Within about an hour and a half, I found a railroad and went up the railroad, a small station, and my co-pilot showed up, and the station keeper, just one kid, he had a little hand car. I got on a hand car, and he pumped us up the track about, I don't know, 3 or 4 miles, 5 miles, to another siding, and there was a freight car, an engine, with about 20, 30 soldiers. And they're Chinese, luckily. So we all got on the damn train. And obviously they had communicated, and everything is fine. And we went about 15 miles came to a big town. I think it's called Yushan, or was. And aside, there were several tracks, pretty good size rail station. Like, and it, things stopped, and we're standing in the open doorway of the freight car, and the tracks and an empty space and a big crowd of people. You could see, I mean, like thousands. And a solitary figure walked across to the train in Western clothes, suit, coat, and he stopped and looked up at us. He says, "Hi, I'm Danny Yang. I'm the mayor of Yushan. And the troops are here to melt them. You are heroes who struck a blow for our freedom." Now, this is 5 o'clock in the afternoon of the 19th of April. It had less than 20 hours. And, you know, how, we don't know. But at any rate, that was our destination, and that's my, me and my people, our crew were the first ones there, and then people started drifting in, and it took about a week for the old man to get there. He was to hell and gone away. Yeah. But at any rate, they collected us all, and then eventually we made our way to Chongqing.
Yeah, when we go through a village, the whole village would follow us down the road, and the Japanese fighter planes were circling around up there. So we didn't appreciate having that much company.
That was like mainly after we got into Free China, though. With it.
Well, all it was the on the mainland.
Oh, yeah.
It was on the mainland, yeah.
Every village we went through, they'd people lined up.
So once Chinese here have had no hesitancy in believing Radio Tokyo on this single greatest piece of news that China has received in 5 years. For a period of 3 hours Saturday afternoon, every Japanese announcer in Tokyo was hemming and hawing with trembling voice and uncertain delivery. They were scared.
Their celebration was short-lived. As Colonel Glines explains, the Japanese were very angry and sought retribution against the Chinese they suspected of having assisted the Doolittle Raiders.
The Japanese were just furious at what had happened in Japan, in their home islands. And the order came out that the Americans were to be pursued and taken care of. Well, every village that the raiders went through, they were feeded by the Chinese. They were fed, they were given protection, and then helped to evade the Japanese, who launched a tremendous invasion, further invasion of China. They'd been there since 1937 along the coastal areas, but pushing further inland to get the Americans and do something about it. And they, worst of the times, before the reaction had settled down, General Chiang Kai-shek messaged President Roosevelt. He was not told about this Doolittle raid. The reason he wasn't told ahead of time was because the people surrounding him couldn't be trusted. And so therefore he was furious, and he cabled President Roosevelt, so the story goes, that 250,000 of his countrymen had been killed as a result of him not knowing about this raid ahead of time. Well, I don't know whether that's a figure he used, and that's where that figure comes from. Okay. He estimated 250,000 Chinese died for any evidence that Americans had been through a village, but they knew they'd done something good for China as they passed through their villages, but they paid dearly for it.
To Doolittle, the loss of all 16 aircraft, coupled with the relatively minor damage the B-25s had inflicted on their targets, the attack was a failure. He was so despondent at the time, he expected a court-martial upon his return to the United States.
That morning I went out, finally found my airplane, and it hit right at the top of a hill, and the two engines had rolled down the hill, just broken off and rolled down. The landing flares had caught fire and burned things, and the little gear that I had in the airplane had been removed. And the airplane was absolutely flat. I sat on this debris thinking that here I am, my first important command. I've lost 100% of my airplanes. Probably most of the men. And I think as I sat on that airplane, began to feel sorry for myself. I had the lowest period in my entire career, and I've done some stupid things. Paul, though, started to cheer me up. And he said, well, when you get back, we'll get this all straightened out. And I said, when I get back, they'll throw me in Leavenworth. He said, Colonel, he said, you know what I think? Just groping for things to cheer me up. He said, I think they'll make you a general for this flight. Thanks, Paul. Still feeling sorry for myself. He said, you know what I think? He tried to think of the thing that would, the greatest thing he could think of. He said, I think you'll get the Congressional Medal of Honor for this flight. I said, Paul, thanks for trying. And finally, he said, General, when this flight is over and you get home, you're going to have another airplane. I want to ask you a favor. I said, what is it, Paul? He said, when you get another airplane, can I continue to be your mechanic? Well, tears came to my eyes, and I said, Paul, if I ever have another airplane, you're the mechanic as long as you want to be.
The one dominant story of the day is the reported bombing of Tokyo, the port of Yokohama, and other cities of Japan. All the reports about the bombings have come from Axis sources. The news has brought jubilation in the various capitals of the Allied nations.
The raid came at a time when this nation needed some good news. They hadn't had any good news for 4 months. And the Japanese, it just seemed like their aggression would never end. They were taking Shanghai, Hong Kong, and were amassing their troops from New Guinea down to Australia. And it just seemed like something's got to be done. Now, fortunately, we didn't lose our carriers at Hawaii, and that gave them the basis for the attack, which eventually became the Doolittle attack on Japan. The nation just was in total shock, and it never had a shock like that. Now, when 16 bombers can be launched from an aircraft carrier. But, of course, the Japanese didn't know that at first, where they came from. The headlines, bombers bomb Japan, was what we needed in big, bold headlines. And we got them all over the country and all over the Allied world. It was a boost that we needed. And, therefore, I think that's why it's remembered. A few men, only 80 men were on that raid, were able to, in our public minds, think the tide has now changed. And it did. It began to change then. And especially when they tried to attack Midway and they lost four carriers of their own. That attack proved that the tide was turning against. We are now going to start to win in the Pacific. And it did.
I'm often asked, what were the results of the raid? Actually, the damage was minimal. We were 16 airplanes, each carrying one ton of bombs. This is very puny when you think of the latter raids of the B-29s, where 500 airplanes would carry 10 tons of bombs each, or 5,000 tons of bombs in one raid against our 16. So you realize how puny it was from the point of view of actual damage. However, it did cause some things to happen. First, the Japanese retained for the defense of the home islands many airplanes that could have been much more effectively used in the battle zone. So the raid had the effect of, to some degree, diluting their future military strength. It caused the Japs to question their warlords, who had told them that Japan would never be attacked. And it gave the U.S. some badly needed good news. Chiang Kai-shek violently opposed the flight, because he rightly said, knowing the Oriental mind, that the Japanese reprisals from such a raid would be terrible. After the raid, the Japanese swarmed inland to wherever our airplanes had been, or wherever the crews had gone, and a conservative estimate is that about 100,000 Chinese were killed by the Japanese in this reprisal activity and in endeavoring to terrorize the Chinese so that they would never again help the Americans. Of the 16 of us, 10 bailed out as I did. One boy's parachute failed, or else he lit on a very precipitous slope. We never found out. We found him. He was found the next morning. And we were able to retrieve his body and bury him. Never knew just what happened, but either his parachute failed or he was killed in the drop. One crash landed in the mud and skidded to a stop. Two crashed in the water near the beach. Four of those were seriously injured. You remember one of them lost his leg, Ted Lawson, and Ted with the boy that Bob Considine wrote the book about, 30 Seconds Over Tokyo. One against orders, because he had a leak in his gas tank, flew to Vladivostok and in Russia, and they were all in turn held prisoners until the war was almost over, then brought near the border and permitted to escape. The one crashed in a lake in Jap-occupied territory, and five of those were captured by the Japanese. One crashed in the water on the seacoast in Jap-occupied territory. Two of them were drowned in the landing, and the other three were captured. Of the eight captured, three were executed. One died of beriberi and malnutrition. They were tortured. They had the customary bamboo splinters put up under their fingernails in order to get them to talk. The boys didn't talk.
For their actions in the Doolittle raid, all 80 raiders received the Distinguished Flying Cross. Jimmy Doolittle was awarded the Medal of Honor by President Roosevelt and promoted two grades, skipping the rank of colonel to brigadier general. Corporal David Thatcher and First Lieutenant Thomas White, a physician who had flown as a gunner on the raid, were each awarded the Silver Star for helping injured crew members evade the Japanese. Every raider who made it to Chungking also received decoration from the Chinese government.
As the raiders left Tokyo with a broad trail of flame and smoke in their wake, Japan tasted war. The raid was but an omen of the eventual destruction to be heaped on Japan from the skies. As Doolittle later promised,
"We're going back to Tokyo, and we shall go in full array and with mighty allies."
This program was produced by the American Veterans Center and the World War II Veterans Committee in association with Radio America. Katie Dempsey, producer. Tim Holbert, executive producer. And narrator, Alan Peterson. To hear this and other audio documentaries, visit www.americanveteranscenter.org.